I represent Sherrod Rowe, who was convicted of conspiracy to distribute cocaine, in part based on two incriminating statements he made in the back of a locked patrol car. Somebody told on us. Somebody told on us. Those statements should not have been admitted at trial because they were the product of a de facto arrest without any probable cause for that arrest. There's no other constitutional basis for admitting those statements, and because of that...
But if Thule, Officer Thule, was told to make a probable cause stop, and is it a woman elected on her own to wait to make the stop until she thought there was a traffic violation? Now we have kind of a two-pronged beast here.
That's right, Your Honor.
But the probable cause to stop change if there was collective probable cause.
That's exactly right.
Your analysis based on what can and can't be done after a valid traffic stop doesn't answer this case. Your brief just assumes in making the extended detention argument, among others, that this is nothing but a traffic stop. It seems to me that that's not true unless they didn't know enough from what was, as the government says, was a reliable confidential informant that a specifically described car was bringing drugs at that time.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me clarify that point, because if that was the point the court took away from my brief, it was unintentional. The issue that the court identified two potential issues there, one being whether there was probable cause to stop based on a traffic violation. I don't think there's any dispute that if there was probable cause to stop based on a traffic violation, excessive window tint, that as a petty misdemeanor in Minnesota, is not an arrestable offense. So the real question is whether, based on the collective knowledge theory of all of the officers involved, including Trooper Thole, who made the stop, there was probable cause to believe that Mr. Rowe was in possession of a large quantity of cocaine. Now, I was not trial counsel in this matter, but as I've read the record, I did not find evidence at the suppression hearing or the trial, which of course is admissible to determine whether or not the motion to suppress was appropriately denied. I didn't see any evidence in there of Trooper Thole indicating that she had any more information about this matter than just that a dispatch report had suggested she should stop this vehicle because it may be involved in possible narcotics trafficking.
That's tipping the scale. It's not unusual in the cases I've seen that are dealing with interstate or non-local drug courier situations where the DEA and other investigators want to get a uniformed officer in a squad car, highway patrol car, to make the stop.
That's right, Your
Honor. And they say, make a stop.
That's exactly right. And in those cases...
And there needs not be any communication as to why to stop.
And so far as the stop goes, that would be sufficient. That doesn't automatically get, and because that would rise to the level of essentially a Terry stop, stopping the vehicle at the side of the road. It does not automatically give probable cause to arrest a person driving a vehicle if there's a dispatch that says this vehicle may be involved in traffic or in narcotics trafficking. The cases.
Okay, but now let me. If my understanding of the facts, taking it what it seems to me to be the next step, is that after Officer Thule, the other officer arrives, and she says, I've done some questioning, you question some more while I go do the traffic stop paperwork so that we don't delay this. And he did some more questioning, and then they went back and somehow conferred with the investigators who said impound the car.
That's, I think, correct, Your Honor. We've got a record in this case, and we also have two videos.
That's where we have the coming together of the two. As I'm reading the facts, knowing them much less well than the lawyers who were involved.
Your Honor, I believe that what happened is that it was Trooper Thull and Officer Wagner who did the questioning, then pulled Mr. Rowe out of the vehicle because they had made the determination that they would bring in a drug dog and potentially tow the vehicle. After that determination was made, and this happens at about, it happens very quickly at about timestamp 10:10 and 10:11 on Exhibit 9 in the motion hearing transcript. It was Officer Wagner's dash cam video. I believe that was after that time, actually, that Special Case Agent Danielle Evans showed up and informed the officers then, well, we're going to detain the car and we're going to detain Mr. Rowe as well.
So it seems to me if the initial probable cause existed when the investigators told dispatch to get a uniformed officer to make the stop, that probable cause authorized not only the stop, but the impoundment of the car to search it, and probably to arrest without more anyone who's driving and therefore in possession of what there's probable cause to believe is there.
Don't disagree with that, Your Honor. I don't believe...
Why doesn't that end the case?
Because I don't believe the record would reflect that at the time Mr. Rowe was brought back to the car, at which time he'd already been handcuffed, been brought back to the squad car by four uniformed officers and put in the back of the car, that the officers who did that had that collective knowledge. The question is really when the officers gleaned the collective knowledge.
The case law just says there has to be communication to have collective knowledge.
Communication is sufficient to give the officers probable cause. I think it's...
No, I don't. Well, of course, that's the fighting issue. Because does the officer in this situation, which I don't think is that uncommon, where the drug investigators want a uniform to do the stop, the arrest, the impounding, they don't have to tell the officer everything that's being done. They have to say, you know, do it.
That's right. But in the cases that we usually see this in, Winarski, Malte, cases like that, what happens...
Wilson I had was a lot like it. The guy that started in Mason City and ended in Des Moines.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't...
Forget.
I don't know that case. But in cases that this typically happens in, there's a stop by a uniform officer, and then that there's a detention until the investigating officers arrive. Sometimes, if it takes a long time for those investigating officers to arrive, the investigating officers will inform the arresting officer of the facts that they know them. For instance, in Malte, that this has been somebody who had gone over the border, that there were secret compartments in a trailer. Here we don't have any evidence of that.
I would suspect that typically happens, but is it constitutionally necessary that it happen?
Under the collective knowledge theory, I believe that it is.
What's your best case from any circuit on that to support the collective knowledge doctrine requires that much communication?
The name escapes me, Your Honor, and it's in our brief in the footnote of our reply brief, footnote 2, and I'll find it for you on when I come back up.
Why does it make sense as a matter of first principles? I mean, if the drug investigators have solid probable cause and they call a uniformed officer and say, we've got solid probable cause that this car is loaded with drugs and the driver knows about it, and the uniformed officer, based on that, arrests the person. Why does it make sense to say that there's no probable cause because the drug officers didn't go through chapter and verse as to why they had probable cause, if they, in fact, did have probable cause?
Well, here we didn't even have that much.
I know, but your legal proposition that you're arguing is that unless the drug investigators communicate chapter and verse, the collective knowledge doctrine doesn't apply. So I'm asking why that makes sense. If in fact there is probable cause, why isn't enough just for the drug investigators to say, we've got probable cause, please execute the arrest for us?
Sure. I suppose it's the whole basis of the collective knowledge theory in the first place, that if the Fourth Amendment rights of the accused and defendants are to be respected.
But how does that disrespect the rights of the accused? That's what I'm trying to follow. Why is that an unreasonable search? If there is, in fact, probable cause and the drug investigators communicate that to the arresting officer and the arresting officer acts on it, mm-hmm. why do you think that's unreasonable?
And I'm not suggesting that the court's cases would require chapter and verse.
Okay.
It requires something more than merely a dispatch and a request that an officer pull somebody over.
But I think an instruction to impound, the investigator doesn't have to come to the scene to do that.
That's right.
And this probable cause is as described, and I don't think it doesn't seem to be challenged. I mean, there is a car coming, specifically described by a reliable informant, that will have drugs today. So the investigators tell the uniform, take it down to the impoundment lot.
Right.
That's not unreasonable. They frequently have to do that because if things are well enough concealed, they won't be discovered in a roadside search anyway.
That's right, and here they weren't. There were no drugs found at the scene.
The investigators, they'll probably then work with the impound people to do the search. The uniform officers are done when the car gets to the impound lot, probably.
That's right. And this is where I think the timing is critical. And unlike the case the court heard earlier this morning, we have good audio and video evidence of this. And my recollection of that review is that the order to impound came after Mr. Rowe was already placed in Officer Wagner's squad car and had already made those incriminating statements. I see I'm just coming into my rebuttal time here, and absent questions from the court, I will reserve the remainder of my time, and I'll get that case site for you, Judge.
I'll give you a little more time. I took some of your time, but it was helpful to me. Ms. Bell.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Assistant United States Attorney Leanne Bell, and I represent the United States on this appeal. I also served as trial counsel and was present at all of the testimony that took place in this case. And so because of that, I am fully aware of the facts and what the facts were both on the video and at the trial, the motions hearing. And I would let the court know that a review of the video would show that, in fact, prior to Mr. Rowe being removed from the vehicle, Trooper Thule was informed via Officer Wagner, who had spoken with investigators on the scene, that, in fact, they had probable cause to tow the vehicle and search it, and that Mr. Rowe should be removed from the vehicle. That's contained within the video, Government's Exhibits 8 and 9. There are two videos, Trooper Thule's and Officer Wagner's, and it is also contained on page 99 of the hearing transcript from the suppression hearing of Mr. Rowe, where Trooper Thule was asked, "Did you believe you had sufficient information to impound the vehicle?" And she said, "Impound the vehicle based on their information. They advised me they had probable cause." So in terms of the timing of the information provided to Trooper Thule, there was the bulletin at the start of her shift to be on the lookout for this particular vehicle. And then while she was on the scene and still completing her paperwork related to the tinted windows, Officer Wagner communicated with officers on scene who were the investigators of the drug case and were informed specifically that there was, in fact, probable cause. And only after that point was Mr. Rowe removed from the vehicle and placed in the back of the squad car. And so I think the court is following the government's brief in realizing that if there's probable cause, which there was, there's really no question about it, the defense isn't moving or objecting to or appealing the district court's ruling that there was probable cause to stop the vehicle itself, as opposed to Mr. Rowe, detaining Mr. Rowe in particular. Because of that, and because of Pringle, there is probable cause to detain this defendant, given the facts and the information that was communicated to this officer. Additionally, if the court were to reach the issue of the prolonging of the stop, I would just point out to the court that the stop wasn't unreasonably prolonged. I think the defendant indicates in his brief that a traffic stop for tinted windows of 25 minutes is just per se unreasonable, but of course that's not really the question. The court's looking at the totality of the circumstances for this particular stop and what was taking place in this particular stop. And the magistrate judge and then the district court made very particular factual findings about what was taking place during the stop and found that Trooper Thule was in fact still doing her paperwork at the time that Mr. Rowe was removed from the BMW and placed in the squad car. And so because she was still working on the window tint portion of the stop, I think the court's right to point out there's sort of two avenues taking place here simultaneously. Because she was working on that portion that she was focused on and was doing that expeditiously, no question, from the factual findings from the court and from the video. There's really no, I think from the party's briefs, there's no dispute about what happened because it was captured on video, including Trooper Sewell's comments, I don't want to delay this any longer than necessary. I'm still completing my paperwork. I'm working to complete my paperwork. And because that was captured on video, there's really no question that the district court abused its discretion in making factual findings about what was happening on the scene.
This is paperwork on the tinted window issue.
Correct. Yeah. She was preparing a warning violation. And so she referred to it as her paperwork. And so because she was completing that and moving along by her own words, in a way so as not to detain him any longer than necessary, were the court to reach the issue of the duration of the stop, the factual findings by the court, which are clearly not abuse of discretion in light of the video, more or less necessitate or result in, under the law, the conclusion that the stop was not prolonged for an impermissible purpose.
On the minimal role procedure, sentencing issue, which is, of course, submitted on the briefs, even if not argued. And it occurred to me, I didn't see any discussion in the briefs about what drug quantity was attributed to Mr. Rowe, which usually may well, which often goes hand in hand with whether a role adjustment should be made. Was he limited in relevant conduct quantity to something less than the full conspiracy?
How the PSR divided up the PSRs divided up the drug quantity is that the two individuals, Green and Williams, who mailed the packages, were held responsible for the 4 kilos total because they mailed them together. So they were held responsible for the 4 kilograms. That they mailed, and Mr. Rowe was responsible for the 6 kilograms of cocaine in the vehicle. Houston Oliver, who's going to be sentenced in a separate case, who was the leader of this, according to the PSR currently, we'll see what Judge Doty finds ultimately, is being held responsible for all 10 kilograms. So he was held responsible for 6 kilograms of cocaine, which is the cocaine in the BMW.
You mean on the view that the other four were not reasonably foreseeable to him for some reason? That was your government's position?
No, that wasn't the government's position. we have a practice, I guess you could say. Our probation office reads drug quantity very, very narrowly, and so tends to assign drug quantity that is not just reasonably foreseeable, but actually assignable to a particular person.
But if the probation office isn't following the law, then the government can object.
Correct. In this case, it wouldn't have made any difference to the guidelines because the amount, 4 kilos, the additional 6 kilograms would not have changed the guideline enhancement. So while we talked about the total conspiracy, there was also money that was taken to Arizona and a number of other things that happened that the government argued affected what his role was and his sentence. From a guidelines perspective, it made no difference to object or not object to it. Last, I'd just like to point out with respect to the issue about the magistrate judge's reliance, or I would say alleged reliance, on the earlier hearing, I have spent a lot of time going through the transcript and pointing the court to the facts and the citations so that the court can rest assured that, in fact, the magistrate judge didn't rely on hearsay, although it was permissible.
Did the government offer that? I mean, it seems like the government's kind of running away from it now, frankly, and saying, well, it wasn't relied on at all. So that raised the question in my mind, what was the point of offering it in the first place?
So as an initial matter, Mr. Rowe was added in the superseding indictment after two co-defendants had already had their motions hearing. And originally, myself and counsel for Mr. Rowe thought we had worked out a plan for how we would proceed because the same magistrate judge heard the same testimony. They had the transcripts, and so we had sort of tried to work out an abbreviated way of getting through this just for efficiency's sake. Ultimately, we could not reach an agreement about what the ground rules for that would be at the motions hearing. And so it went back and forth and back and forth for a fairly extended period of time until the judge said, look, let's just have the testimony. I'll look at everything and we'll just move forward at this point. At the conclusion of the first witness's testimony, Sergeant Biederman, at the first hearing, she asked defense counsel, the magistrate judge said, have you asked this witness everything you want to ask them? Anything that you would want to cross-examine them about related to prior testimony, the prior transcripts, anything, because I might rely on this, the earlier testimony, in making my decision here. And defense counsel said, I've asked everything I wanted to. At the conclusion of the second witness, she asked the same thing, and at that point, the defense objected to the procedure. So it was kind of a...
What was the prior hearing? Was it admitted as in the record?
It
of the suppression hearing? Was it suppression hearing evidence, the prior transcript?
The transcript was not admitted. We all referred to it on the record. It was on the docket, so we didn't actually make it a separate exhibit. We just simply referred to the prior hearing.
So the magistrate then made a ruling based on evidence not in the record?
No, Your Honor. The magistrate judge did not make a ruling, any rulings, based on the information from the earlier hearing.
But referred to it.
She did refer to it, but she didn't need to. So as she noted in her... She noted in her footnote...
It's not argued as error. It strikes me as error.
To refer to information from the prior hearing.
You're saying it was in the...
It's not in the record.
Well, is it in the record or not? I mean, you're saying it's a public transcript on the docket sheet of this same... of a different defendant's case? Or is this a consolidated case or what?
It was all the same case. So same case number. He was superseded after the original defendant.
So if you go to the docket sheet for all the defendants, this transcript would be earlier on the docket.
Correct.
But this defendant wasn't present at the hearing, and his lawyer wasn't present.
He was not, which is why the magistrate judge, I think, noted the earlier hearing, but then made the specific footnote in her R&R that the testimony at both hearings was nearly identical, and I was at both, and as I was the questioner, I can tell you it was literally almost identical. And then she said... Even if...
Well, there was a different critical witness on the probable cause.
Your Honor, there was not a critical witness different.
They were working together, but the woman who testified at the Oliver hearing didn't testify at this hearing.
And there's never been an objection or a concern about the other case agent
testifying.
I know, testifying.
But this strikes me as evidentiary very suspect.
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't... If that had happened,
the public record, if we're relying on testimony, is establishing facts.
If the court had relied on the testimony, I think we could get further into that discussion. But the court didn't.
Well, when
simply
the magistrate
did not.
Says, you know, you can question all these. You can question the witnesses, and that'll let me look at the old testimony. And then one of the witnesses doesn't appear.
So at the start of the hearing, everyone knew who the witnesses were going to be. There was never a request to have. To a continuation of the hearing, to call the other witness because they were co-case agents and had the same information to provide at the hearing and did, in fact, testify about the exact same set of facts because they were the co-case agents together. The court, if you look at the citations, there are 30 citations, actually more than 30, citations to various transcripts and exhibits within the R&R. On four times, she cited dual citations to both the earlier and the later hearing. And in every one of those circumstances, the testimony was identical. So let me give you an example.
Did you say this to the district court when there was an objection? Because it looks like the government was still pushing the prior hearing at the district court level because the district court ruled that it was okay to use it.
The government's position was that the prior hearing was not necessary. We had elicited the exact same testimony at the second hearing, all the same facts that the court needed to make its decision, and that while hearsay is permissible at a hearing, the court doesn't need to, in order to resolve the issue of the R&R, of the suppression itself, doesn't need to address that, but the court did anyway.
Did Rowe's lawyer have advance notice that the magistrate judge would or might rely on the prior transcripts so that he could read them all?
Yes, Your Honor. I specifically had conversation with him, and we showed up at the hearing with a plan. If you read the transcript, we start out saying, I think we've reached a plan to try to do this most efficiently, and then we could not agree on the ground rules for a variety of reasons. And so ultimately, we put the testimony on, and ultimately, the court, although made the citations, I can tell you that the transcripts are literally identical. And I'll give you one example. The only citation of the four in the entire R&R that the defendant actually talks about the facts in his reply brief, he says that the R&R found that the drug sniffing dog alerted to the possible presence of narcotics inside the speaker trunk. That's what the R&R found, that the drug sniffing dog alerted. And the defense points out in its brief that Trooper Sewell did not testify that the drug dog alerted because she said, I'm not a canine handler. I can't testify to the fact of the alert of the dog. And in fact, what she said at the hearing was, she was asked, question, so the trunk was open and the dog was searching the trunk, correct? And she said, I'm not a canine handler, so I can't say the trunk is open when the dog is present. In essence, I can't tell you what the dog is doing because I am not a canine handler. But then she said, on page 70 of the transcript, I was aware the dog alerted on the rear of the vehicle or the trunk of the vehicle. So she said, testified similarly at the earlier hearing when she was asked about what the dog was doing while he was sniffing. And she said, I can't testify about what the dog was doing. I'm not a canine handler. I was told the dog alerted on the vehicle. So her testimony in the earlier and later hearing are actually nearly identical, although the questions are phrased slightly differently. And so I'm not running away from the issue. I'm merely pointing out that there is no reliance on the earlier hearing for any fact.
The reason you brought it up in the first place was you thought it would be more efficient. Is that the government's, because you wouldn't have to repeat the same direct examination? Is that the idea here?
The idea was we were trying to narrow the issue. So under the meet and confer rules that we have for local rules now in the District of Minnesota, we were trying to narrow what the issues were. And so there were some facts that we didn't disagree about. There was a traffic stop. There was the videos. There were some things we were trying to narrow. And so the idea would be, I think initially was, well, can we just admit the transcripts as exhibits to sort of deal with those foundational questions? And then we just couldn't reach an agreement. And that's ultimately what happened. We could not reach an agreement. Thank you.
Mr. Mikko, I'll have some time.
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
I'd like to focus for just a minute about the procedures used by the district court because they appeared to cause this court some concern. It was very unusual. In fact, there's pending before the court now a motion to supplement this record to include the transcript from the earlier suppression hearing because it's, as you pointed out, Judge Loken, it's not a part of this record. It is extrajudicial. And in fact, it's not really hearsay either because what it is statements from separate witnesses at a separate hearing. Now, of course, under Thompson in this circuit, hearsay is sometimes permissible because we have relaxed standards of or constitutional standards at suppression hearings. But at least when we're talking about hearsay, the witness is available for cross-examination about what the declarant might have said, how things might have gone forward.
I thought you had the actual declarants in this hearing.
No.
Except for the one, it's just the one agent who was not present?
Trooper Thole testified at both hearings. Case Agent Biederman testified at Mr. Rowe's hearing, and Case Agent Evans testified at the prior hearing.
Evans is the only one. The other two...
That's right.
Or I don't know if there were... How many other witnesses were cited by the magistrate judge?
Those were the two critical. I don't think any others were.
Thole
and Biederman and Evans, yep.
Your real complaint is about her citing Evans.
Yes, and the notion...
About the government's position that whatever Evans said was said again by Biederman, and so...
Well,
make any difference.
You know, two things on that. First of all, the fact that the district court said, I'm citing all of this evidence, but don't worry, I'm not relying on it. I mean, presumably as a matter of judicial efficiency, matters are cited for some reason. Now, even if that reason is just because that is confirmatory and therefore supports the credibility in the subsequent test or in the subsequent hearing, that's still important. And it's the government's burden to show that this error was harmless if the court agrees with me that it was error to rely on the prior hearing.
Now, but what's your prejudice argument? I guess the reply brief cites the dog sniffs reference, but that's not relevant to the probable cause issues we've been arguing this morning.
No, but it is
after the key events.
That's right.
So where's the prejudicial reference to the prior transcript?
And in our initial brief, we cited all of the areas in which the district court relied upon the prior hearing.
Then why it was prejudice?
Probable cause, for instance. The district court citations.
What probable cause testimony was there in the earlier transcript that there wasn't in this one?
It was the same, Your Honor. It was generally the same. However, the fact that it was put forward by different witnesses and that
one different witness.
Yes. Well.
Not well.
I'm not stretching the point. I'm mentioning that I'm simply making the point that at the other hearing it was a different witness.
As you presented, it's much ado about nothing. I'm not particularly enamored of the way it was handled. Like, I can understand why it came up and why it was a little messy, but I don't hear anything that had it outcome affecting.
And if the court finds that the error is harmless, then that's another thing. We don't believe that the government met its burden on that. I'll mention on the minor role adjustment, Your Honor, the reason we didn't identify the kilograms of cocaine for each of the defendants is that at the time the briefing was done, the quarterback, as Sergeant Biederman called him, had not been convicted. That's Houston Oliver. Clearly, Mr. Rowe is subordinate.
The reason I raise it is, as now that I have no more facts, if all 10 kilograms had been attributed to Mr. Rowe as opposed to just the quantity he was couriering, then the minor Rowe argument becomes stronger, if you will.
Right. I appreciate the time. Absent further questions from the court, I'll sit down.
Thank you, and thank you again for serving in the Criminal Justice Act. Case has been well briefed and argued. We'll take it under advisement. The court will be in